and Virginia, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, Boston, and Park Rapids at 89.9 in Brainerd, Merrifield, Nisswa, and Mission Township. You can hear us at KEXE.org or through your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio thanks to you and still here going strong almost 50 years. If you have, though the decision was made in July, October 1st was the first day that KEXE is operating without federal funding since its first year of inception in 1976. Our listeners like you have come forward to make sure we stay on the air. We're using those numbers, those dollars that you've contributed to find other ways to support this station. We believe in it. We have confidence we will go forward, and thank you so much. You can text the word donate right now to 218-326-1234. It's 601. News is next.
News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Senators plan to take another vote today on a short-term funding proposal as the government shutdown enters its third day. This as both sides blame the other for the impasse. Democrats want a deal on extending health subsidies for the Affordable Care Act plans that are set to expire soon. Republicans argue those subsidies are too expensive. Meanwhile, the shutdown means that the monthly government jobs report won't be released today. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
Means that labor economists can sleep in a little bit, especially those on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. They typically have to be at their computers at 5:30 a.m. Pacific time to digest this potentially market-moving information about how many jobs were added or subtracted in each industry and what happened to the workforce and whether the unemployment rate moved up or down. You know, the monthly jobs report is one of the government's most closely watched economic releases.
NPR Scott Horsley. And the inflation report due out in a couple of weeks could be delayed as well because government price checkers would be gathering the information for that report right now. Hamas says it's still studying President Trump's 20-point plan to end the war in Gaza and chart a new future for the territory in which the militant group is disarmed. NPR's Aya Batraoui has more.
Hamas official Mohammed Nazal told Al Jazeera the group is not viewing Trump's plan with a, quote, black or white mindset and is looking at gray areas where there could be movement. He says the priority is ending the, quote, genocide in Gaza, but that Hamas will not accept a take-it-or-leave-it ultimatum. He says Hamas has many comments on Trump's plan that need further explanation. Mediators Egypt and Qatar say they're urging Hamas to respond positively to Trump's plan, but senior officials from both countries have also said the plan needs more discussion around what follows the release of Israeli hostages, particularly around issues of governance and security in Gaza. For example, Egypt's foreign minister says there must be a clear mandate and a UN Security Council resolution for the deployment of Arab forces in Gaza after the war. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
Apple says it's removed services from its app store used for anonymously reporting U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. NPR's Bobby Allen reports it follows the Trump administration's pressuring the tech company to block the app.
The creators of IceBlock describe it as Waze, but for ICE sightings. It shot to the top of App Store charts this summer amid the Trump administration's stepped-up immigration enforcement. Now, Apple says the app can no longer be downloaded on iPhones, saying it poses a risk to law enforcement. Apple's action comes shortly after Attorney General Pam Bondi claimed the app is designed to put ICE agents at risk just for doing their jobs. The developer of IceBlock says the intention was not to harm law enforcement, but to serve as an early warning system. Since January, the number of ICE arrests has risen sharply, with triple the number of arrests in some states compared to last year. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Fire crews are battling massive flames at a Chevron refinery just outside of Los Angeles that can be seen for miles. Officials in El Segundo, about a mile from LAX airport, urged people to stay indoors last night but say there's no immediate threat to public safety and no evacuations. Chevron says there were no injuries, all personnel are accounted for, and that a monitoring system indicated that the fire did not move beyond the facility's fence line. The cause of the blaze is under investigation. The Church of England has named a woman as its top leader for the first time. Sarah Mullally is the new Archbishop of Canterbury. She's leading the world's 85 million Anglicans. NPR's Lauren Freyer has more from London.
Mulali is a 63-year-old mother of two who first trained as a nurse, then an Anglican priest, then a bishop. She also sits in the House of Lords, the upper chamber of the UK Parliament, and was the youngest person ever appointed as chief nursing officer for England. Mulali replaces Justin Welby, who resigned as archbishop after an inquiry found he failed to report child abuse at Christian summer camps. She'll lead a church divided over the consecration of women as bishops and the treatment of LGBTQ people. A group of Anglican churches in Africa and Asia has already said it rejects Mulali's appointment, saying it shows the English arm of the church has, quote, relinquished its authority to lead. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
U.S. futures contracts are trading higher at this hour. Dow futures are up about 0.2%. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
Pam Perry from Brainerd is a regular contributor to the KAXE Morning Show. She talks about birds and other wildlife. We asked her why she supports this station.
So, and now the most recent thing is the newsroom. And I love the news reports. You're not hearing that anywhere else. You're not hearing about what county boards are doing and local governments. This is the place. This is where you're going to hear about it. And the music was wonderful. You know, and you had your volunteer hosts. And again, local people often. I want to support it. I want to support something. And then, of course, when I was listening, I was going, where else do you hear about bud break and plants and birds and forestry and all the things that, you know, we're Northern Minnesota.
You can become a member like Pam Perry. Give now at KAXE.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Good morning. 3 days into a government shutdown, neither side is showing signs of giving ground. In a few minutes, we'll speak with White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt to hear the administration's view. But first, we'll get the latest from Capitol Hill.
The Trump administration has said it will take the opportunity to increase the pain on their fellow Americans by firing federal workers. Senate Majority Leader John Thune is not warning them off.
Anytime you're in this situation, you have to manage a shutdown. Decisions have to be made about what to prioritize, where you're going to spend money. I expect there are going to be some decisions coming out about that. That wouldn't surprise me at all.
The Republican-led Senate will vote for the fourth time today on partisan stopgap bills that are expected to fail.
NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales has been reporting on all this and joins us now. Hi, Claudia.
Good morning, Leila.
Good morning. So why go through the motion of voting on these dueling bills when they don't have the votes?
Right. Leader Thune says this is a tactic to pressure Democrats to fold, let Republicans overcome a filibuster holding up government funding. They need Democrats to reach this required 60-vote threshold today, but we're not expecting them to help. So far, only three have defected to vote with Republicans. And as we know, the GOP only controls 53 Senate seats, so they need at least seven Democrats, probably more, as one Republican, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, is expected to vote no. The rest of the Democratic caucus has said they will not help unless Republicans address expiring subsidies for the Affordable Care Act or ACA program.
And this is also a big issue for Americans. 20 million people could see their insurance premiums spike, in some cases double. If these expire, are Senate Republicans willing to talk at this point?
Not really. Not right now. A bipartisan group was in talks this week. I followed up with one member, Senator Mike Rounds of South Dakota. He said Republicans were simply trying to convince Democrats first vote on this stopgap, known as a continuing resolution or CR.
If they don't pass a short-term CR, there is no way of getting anything done in time to do the things that they want to with regard to ACA subsidies.
So he says these subsidies have to go through a separate bill that's stuck behind this showdown. But for Democrats, there's a chance this is a bait and switch, so most are not budging for now.
Now, Vice President Vance was publicly insisting there's no rush to renew the subsidies since they don't take effect until next year. Is there plenty of time on this?
Well, Democrats would argue no. These subsidies don't expire until the end of the year, but they say with open enrollment coming up next month, they say that needs to be handled now. So you could say Democrats are fighting as well for a popular issue. Perhaps there's a political calculation here too. NPR has reported that 24 million people are enrolled. They include influential voters, active voters like small business owners, farmers, and ranchers.
So lawmakers went into this shutdown feeling it was inevitable. At this point, do they show any urgency about ending it?
Well, we didn't see much this week. We just saw a lot of posturing. For example, President Trump threatened mass layoffs, cutting, quote, Democratic agencies, and met with the head of management and budget, Russell Vogt, on the next steps there. But when I asked Republicans about these cuts, like you heard Thune there at the top, they say it's the administration's prerogative. What's partly fueling the stalemate is a lot of government agencies are still running. Federal paychecks haven't been missed yet, so the American public hasn't noticed much. But as this stretches on, the pressure will only build on Congress and the president.
NPR's Claudia Grisales. Thank you, Claudia.
Thank you.
We are hearing multiple perspectives on the shutdown, and that includes Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary, who's on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you guys so much for having me.
I'm glad you're on. Good to talk with you again. As everybody knows, the president likes to make deals. What's his plan to get out of this?
Look, the president does love to make deals, and he offered Democrats on Capitol Hill a very simple deal to pass a clean continuing resolution. That's what the president supported. That's what Republicans introduced. And this is a bipartisan piece of legislation. There were three Senate Democrats who eventually voted for it, but that is not enough. Not enough Democrats voted for this common sense, clean continuing resolution to keep the government open. So unfortunately, we are now in a federal government shutdown, and this is not what President Trump wanted. So the White House is continuing to work with our colleagues on Capitol Hill. We're in talks with moderate Democrat senators who know that this is not the right thing to do, who know that they supported this exact same piece of legislation to keep the government open. As recently as March, they've supported it 13 times in the past. There is zero reason for them to now be pushing this shutdown in the name of health care. Right now, we need to keep the government open. Discussions about health care can happen after we do that. And the president is continuing to encourage people on Capitol Hill to vote for this clean.
It sounds to me like you're not going the different paths you could take. You're not necessarily going to the Democratic leadership. You're going to see if you can pick off a few more moderate Democrats and get up to 60 votes to get out of this. Is that the idea?
Well, the president did go to the Democratic leadership. We had Senator Chuck Schumer and the House Majority Leader Hakeem Jeffries at the White House just last week, and the president offered them an opportunity to come to their senses, and unfortunately, they chose a different path. They remained defiant, and they picked a partisan fight over health care funding, which, by the way, is a fight and a discussion worth having, but we can't have it at the ninth hour when the federal government is shutting down, and now our troops are going without pay. We have federal staff that have been furloughed from their jobs, federal staff that are working without pay, and that's unacceptable, and it's deeply unfortunate.
Now, let's talk about this this assertion that is made on the Democratic side. They are wanting to extend tax credits for Obamacare health insurance subsidies, health insurance premiums, rather. And I just want to put out some numbers that NPR has reported, because there's a lot of heat about this. I want to try to bring some light. There are 24 million Americans, roughly, who use these marketplaces. They benefit from these tax credits. The enrollment is not for next year. The enrollment actually comes in a few weeks, November 1st. And those millions of people are citizens and taxpayers who are about to be faced with much higher premiums. Does the president have a plan to address that concern before they start enrolling November 1st?
Look, the president, the vice president, the White House has consistently said, we are very much going to engage on this issue and have robust discussions about it and figure out what is the best policy for our country moving forward. But right now, we need to reopen the government so those discussions can continue.
But the clean resolution would push you back November 1st. I do understand that the calendar is the clean resolution would push you back beyond November 1st. You wouldn't be able to do it in time.
Well, the premiums that you're discussing don't expire until the end of the calendar year. And so right now we need to keep the government open. We want to pass a clean continuing resolution for the next 7 weeks. Then we'll address the budget fight once again when that 7 weeks lapses. But at least in those 7 weeks, those discussions on health care and all of the other issues our country is facing can continue. And you've had the Vice President of the United States say numerous times, as soon as we reopen the government, he will go to Capitol Hill right away to discuss this very important topic of health care. But right now, again, the government needs to reopen. We have people who cannot afford critical food assistance. You look at members of our military, air traffic controllers, federal law enforcement officers, all of whom are having to work without pay right
now.
That's
absolutely true. They're not being paid. But I want to ask about something else here. The administration says it's preparing to fire people. I know there was a meeting about that earlier in the week. And the president said before the shutdown, quote, we can do things during the shutdown that are irreversible, that are bad for them. What is the reason to do bad things here, and what bad things are planned?
Well, unfortunately, we have to do things we don't want to do because the government is completely shut down and there's zero money coming into the federal government's coffers.
People are still paying
taxes.
And
so right now, the Office of Management and Budget is taking a hard look at the balance sheet and having to understand what agencies do we have to cut, who do we have to lay off in order to keep this thing running and in order to be good stewards of the American taxpayer dollar.
I'm trying to figure that out. I mean, first, tax money is still coming in. This does seem to be a short-term issue. It's not like the government is about to run out of money. There's an authority not to spend money or not.
Well, we're $37 trillion in debt. So
this I understand.
A fiscal crisis
granted,
in our
granted. But the president has talked about shutting down what he calls Democrat agencies. Which agencies are the Democrat agencies?
Well, that's something that the White House is currently discussing, and the president is meeting with the Office of Management and Budget to try to understand what agencies are essential, what agencies do not align with the administration's priorities and values. I think every single one of your listeners would agree the federal government is way too big. And so where can we cut back to save money in a responsible way that respects the American taxpayers' money, especially when we are in this financial crunch right now in the midst of a Democrat shutdown?
When the administration canceled an $18 billion spending on infrastructure projects in New York City, was that a shot at Chuck Schumer of New York and Democrats in general in a blue state?
Well, look, this is one of the many things we're taking a look at. What are these wasteful projects doing? And by the way, the reason for that is because the Department of Transportation workers who were working and pushing out the funds for that were all furloughed. They can't show up to work right now. So that project is currently temporarily halted because of Chuck Schumer's shutdown. So Chuck Schumer did that to himself. He did that to his constituents in New York. If the government remained open because Chuck Schumer and the Democrats voted for it, that project, that infrastructure project would be ongoing.
Oh,
right,
interesting.
Now.
I thought it had been canceled. So you're saying it's only temporary. That's helpful. We just got
Correct.
A few seconds left, but I want to ask one other thing, Ms. Leavitt, because we have another guest on the program coming up in a little while. We're going to hear from Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock. If you had an opportunity to ask her a question, what question would you ask? Ask him a question. What question would you ask?
I would ask, please, please, why don't you do the right thing by your constituents in Georgia and vote to keep the government open. Let's reopen the government, and then we can have a robust debate on the issue of health care. That's what I would pass along to the senator.
Caroline Leavitt is the White House press secretary. Thanks for joining us this morning. Hope to have you back sometime.
Thank you.
And Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock is coming in a bit. This is Morning Edition from NPR News.
6:19. Thanks for tuning in to the Friday Morning Show. It's People Powered KAXC. Coming up from Morning Edition, we are learning about Sean Combs being sentenced, as well as the latest installment of StoryCorps, this time a homeless man talking about caring for his elderly aunt. I'm Heidi Holton with John Bauer. Thanks so much for tuning in. An hour from now, get a chance to talk with Marshall Helmberger about the Border News Roundup. He's bringing us the story, the big story that's going to be happening today about whether the Minnesota Public Utility Commission will sell Minnesota Power, expected to vote on that today, on whether the parent company should be sold to a pair of private investment firms. We've got What's for Breakfast soccer style today. No doubt we're going to talk about the Minnesota Lynx and last weekend's bizarro weekend and toughness and these great women athletes and the WNBA finals that are going on now on the sports page. So if you like hot summertime, this is good, but it is October 3rd after all, and everybody I know is wanting to wear socks and wanting to wear sweaters. Temperatures today 82 to 85, evening lows in the mid to upper 60s, could be mid to upper 80s by Saturday. More news is coming up next from Morning Edition here on People Powered KAXC. Thanks for tuning in.
PR comes from this station. And from Focus Features, presenting Anemone, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. Two brothers wrestle with their past and the one secret that has kept them apart for decades. Anemone, rated R, in theaters today. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The writer Jill Lepore wrote a history of the United States called These Truths. Now she's gone through the same history again for a book on the Constitution. She focuses on fights to amend or reinterpret our basic law long after it was drafted in 1787.
I just really love the agitation of it all.
The book We the People covers a lot of history. I asked Jill Lepore about one period that feels relevant now. In the early 1900s, Americans confronted a growing industrial economy, income inequality, and mass immigration. They responded with constitutional amendments, from women's voting rights to an income tax. And a powerful president, Woodrow Wilson, reinterpreted the document.
Wilson had, in fact, been a constitutional scholar. He advocated what came to be called and is still often called living constitutionalism.
Among other things, Wilson signed into law the creation of an independent Federal Reserve, setting aside claims that the Constitution did not allow it. That is the very same Fed whose independence President Trump is challenging now. Lepore says Wilson's idea of a living Constitution differed from the framers' idea of the Constitution as a machine.
So when they talked about checks and balances, you know, they're picturing weights on strings balancing one another. And Wilson, he wanted to move beyond that notion, and he argued that the Constitution is an organism, a living thing that has to be allowed to grow naturally. And that remains in many ways a debate that Americans still have about the very nature of the Constitution.
Woodrow Wilson, I have noticed, still bothers modern-day conservatives. I want to play a bit of a recent interview with John Yoo, who's a conservative legal scholar, talking about that. Let's listen.
People like Woodrow Wilson, who I think is in many ways the godfather of this idea, thought that there were scientific answers to public policy, that you could get things exactly right, and so that politics were a dirty, messy business, and the last thing you would want then if you created a Federal Trade Commission or the Federal Reserve, probably the most powerful of our independent agencies.
Yeah.
Is to allow a president elected at the head of a party to govern what it does.
What was it that Wilson and some of his successors like Franklin Roosevelt were doing to the government and to society?
Well, I think we just need to maybe pause for a moment to say that the left has also disavowed Wilson.
True.
For his racism. Wilson was a Southerner who segregated the civil service. So Wilson and, of course, later FDR, but a number of Republicans in between were all involved in fortifying the federal government to steer the United States through the turn to a modern industrial economy and to try to find ways to adjust the U.S. Constitution to keep pace with what these developments meant for ordinary people. One of the things I found really kind of fun in working on this book was, so you can find all the arguments that a John Yoo is making now. You can find those in the 1920s and 1930s.
What was the effect on society that it was decided for that time that it was legal and constitutional, upheld by the Supreme Court, incidentally, to have independent agencies, technocrats, people trying by their lights to apply the best solutions to various economic problems with at least some insulation from directly elected officials?
Well, you get the buffering of the forces of the market. You get an insulation against the worst excesses of monopoly. You know, by the time you get to the 1930s, democracies all over the world are collapsing. They're kind of going in either direction, towards communism or towards fascism, you know, a kind of state-controlled economy. And FDR finds a way, a kind of compromise position, to adjust the strictures within the Constitution to both protect the free market and also protect against the worst excesses of a free market.
In listening to you, I think you're saying that Franklin Roosevelt and some other presidents had an idea to respond to an ever larger and more powerful and more complicated economy with a more active government that was supposed to engage in the economy but not be under the hands of a dictator, as was happening in other countries around the world. Was that the idea that we're now, to some extent, challenging?
Yes. I mean, it is FDR's agenda and his accomplishments are depicted by extremists as extreme for the purpose of demonizing the New Deal. That was the case in the 1930s. It was unsuccessful then. I think it will ultimately be unsuccessful now because the kinds of benefits that accrue to societies as a whole in having an active federal government, the more those provisions are dismantled and withdrawn from ordinary Americans, the more visible they become and their absence becomes more painful.
What excites you when you go back to this era of people pushing for reform, pushing for changes to the Constitution or to its meaning?
It's just a much bigger, more colorful, wildly interesting canvas of constitutional history that makes me feel quite a bit better about a sense of possibility moving forward. I think to the degree that we kind of narrow our vision and look through a very, very tiny, tiny lens, like a little monocle, we feel kind of trapped in a very polarized, very stuck politics and very kind of stuck era of constitutionalism. But if you widen that out and look at the whole of American history in that broad canvas with teeming actors with all kinds of loud opinions and silent protests and nonviolent action and everything else and in between, it's a kind of glorious history.
You also, by taking this wide lens, make me think about unintended consequences. People push for a change, and it turns out that whatever they thought would happen is not what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes people have been asking, your book seems to be just celebrating amendment for its own sake. Actually, a lot of amendment ideas are really terrible ideas. And some of them, once put in place, turn out to not have the effect that was hoped for, or they're betrayed, or they're defied. I mean, we're looking right now, and we're in a moment right now where the birthright citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment, the Trump administration is insisting doesn't mean what it says. So, you know, there are very difficult constitutional battles ahead, but there's a lot to be learned from the way those battles were waged in the past.
Jill Lepore is the author of We the People, A History of the U.S. Constitution. Such a pleasure to talk with you again, Jill.
Oh, thanks so much, Steve.
This is NPR News.
Daniel Day-Lewis has not been living alone in the woods for 20 years, but his newest character has. The actor unretired to star in his son's debut feature film.
I thought, I wonder if we can cook something up just for the pure pleasure of working together.
I'm Elsa Chang. Father and son talk about their film, Anemone, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is coming up this afternoon. It's at 4 o'clock with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. It is 6:29. I'm Heidi Holton with John Bauer, and it's another steamy kind of morning. And October 3rd today, and we are expecting temperatures to get into the mid-80s.
Wow.
So hang on.
I guess.
All week, they've been saying kind of it'll cool down by the weekend, but we're still looking at, by Sunday, 77 to 80 degrees. So today, there's some patchy, dense fog. I'm sure you saw that as you rode on in, John.
That's sure did.
Until about 10 a.m., partly sunny through the day, up to 85 today, and partly cloudy overnight, temperatures in the mid to upper 60s. Pretty warm for an overnight.
And, you know, in the fall, it just has a different heat for some reason. It just feels different. But, yeah, it's been pretty warm, a little bit of wind. But if you look outside today, this morning, the stars are shining bright. It's beautiful out there. Patchy fog today. Until 10, highs 81 to 85 with east winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. Lows tonight in the 60s, breezy still, 20 mile per hour winds out of the southeast. Saturday, sunny again with highs in the mid to upper 80s. Breezy, 15 to 30. And then Sunday, mostly sunny, a chance of showers. Again, 77 to 80 degrees.
Coming up, we've got National Native News. The president of the Oglala Sioux Tribe has denounced Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's decision not to revoke medals awarded for one of the history's most infamous massacres. Stay tuned for that story. We've also got local news for you coming up about 7:01 with the Up North Report, and then news from northeastern Minnesota. Marshall Helmberger at 7:20. Talking about the Minnesota Power, big thing happening there today about proposed sale, and we're also hearing a little bit there at peak of color, but muted just as we are, and we'll learn a lot more.
Yes, we will. I want to thank Grand Dental Center, where Drs. Lisa Johnson and Leanne McBride and their staff provide full-service family dental care for patients of all ages in Grand Rapids and surrounding communities. GrandDental.com. Heidi, swan sightings on the lake?
No, we're not a swan place like
we
you are.
We had 26 yesterday, and they're just flocking up. It's a beautiful thing.
Had some kind of owl sort of really big screeching the minute I woke up today, almost like it would kind of screech and then it would sound like a dog bark almost.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's pretty haunting and cool.
Yeah, glad you slept though before that.
Yeah. What are you hearing? What are you seeing? What kind of birds? You can text us this morning at 218-326-1234. In this half hour, we're going to bring you information about live music in our region, and we've got our talkback segment. It's a doozy because our question of the week evoked so many stories about grocery stores of our youth. So stay tuned for all of it coming up. And then at 9 o'clock, Malachi Coons is our host for Headwaters.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The president of the Oglala Sioux Tribe has denounced the decision by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth not to revoke medals awarded for one of history's most infamous massacres. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire has more.
In late December 1890, members of the 7th Cavalry attempted to disarm a large group of Chief Spotted Elk's followers they had encircled at Wounded Knee Creek, South Dakota. A shot went off, and the soldiers mowed down the group of largely Native women, children, and elders with rifles and powerful Hotchkiss guns. 25 soldiers were killed by friendly fire as well. Later investigations showed fleeing survivors were chased down and killed where they stood. The following year, 20 U.S. soldiers received the Medal of Honor for gallantry at Wounded Knee, but top brass, including Major General Nelson A. Miles, condemned the incident as, quote, the most abominable military blunder and a horrible massacre of women and children. Efforts to revoke the medals gained momentum starting in 1990, the centennial of the incident. But in a video posted to his X account last week, Secretary Hegseth said the 20 soldiers who fired upon the Lakota natives will not have their medals revoked.
We're making it clear that they deserve those medals. This decision is now final, and their place in our nation's history is no longer up for debate.
We'll continue to fight to get these medals rescinded.
Oglala Sioux Tribal President Frank Starr comes out as a descendant of Spotted Elk and a Marine veteran of the Gulf War in Mogadishu. He says he's not surprised by Hegseth's decision, but it still speaks to the indifference of those who don't know their history.
It's despicable, it's untruthful, and insulting to our people.
In a press release, the Oglala Sioux tribe says descendants of those scarred by Wounded Knee have served honorably in every U.S. conflict from World War I to Afghanistan. And every year, an annual memorial ride is held to honor those killed at Wounded Knee. Again, Frank Starr comes out.
This is history. This is something that our people are traumatized with, and we have to live with that. And I keep saying this every time I go to Washington to advocate, not only for the Oglala Sioux tribe, and tribes nationwide. You know, we were never dealt a fair hand.
Meanwhile, the National Congress of American Indians has also denounced Hegseth's decision and are calling on the U.S. Congress to pass what's called the Remove the Stain Act so that, quote, the nation's highest honor fulfills its namesake by reflecting courage, not cowardice and cruelty. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Belfast City Council in Ireland approved a historic policy for the island's indigenous language, as Sean McPullen reports.
Belfast City Councillors approved the new Irish language policy this week. It comes after years of advocacy and consultations with the indigenous language community. The city plans to redesign its logo to now include the original Irish spelling of Bailfirstia, which means mouth of the sandbank ford. The policy also pledges to ensure all city signs contain both languages. Far-right councillors tried to block the new policy, but were unsuccessful. The council previously earmarked the equivalent of $2.5 million to fund the changes, as well as new initiatives that remove barriers for the use of Irish in public life. The Irish language has been experiencing a renaissance of late, particularly among young speakers, in part thanks to the worldwide success of the Belfast band Kneecap. For National Native News, I'm Sean McPullen in Ireland.
The Cherokee Nation partnered with DreamWorks Animation and NBC Universal to dub the animated film How to Train Your Dragon in the Cherokee language. The Oklahoma tribe held a private screening of the film this week, which is streaming on Peacock. It's part of the tribe's Cherokee language preservation efforts. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding in part from the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. They have a great app through Kawanak that includes National Native News as well as Native American Calling, a noontime national call-in show that's great. You can check that out as well. We've been meeting, John, with in trainings, and some of the folks from Kawanak are in the trainings with us. We've gotten to know them a little bit. As we are preparing mid-month here, it's not official. This is a secret. We got a new podcast rolling out about nature. So you're going to want to stay tuned for that. That'll be coming up in about a week and a half.
When maybe will you be able to make that announcement?
I just did.
Well.
How's that?
Well, it's kind of a teaser.
Well, I'm behind on my to-do list.
So okay.
It was supposed to be a few days ago. So how's
that? That's all right. That's all right. It's cool outside, but it's going to be hot today. Again, we're going to be in the 80s for the next couple days, maybe the next 3 days. So, you know, if you're looking, like Heidi and I were just talking off air, I really wanted to throw on like a hoodie or something this morning, but you
can't.
Sweater
weather.
You can't.
Sweater weather. That's what we're looking for.
It's coming, though. It's coming. I want to thank the Rife Center, the Rife in Grand Rapids, presenting Colin Bracewell for its Cozy Concert Series, October 17th at 7. Bracewell performs original music combining elements of indie and pop with saxophone. Details at therife.org.
There's so much going on this weekend. We're going to be talking about Grand Rapids arts and events going on throughout our entire morning. Let us know what you're up to. You can text 218-326-1234. Tonight is a opening reception from 5 to 7 for Kristen Anderson at Watermark Art Center in Bemidji. Anderson's exhibit is called Refugia, the Seasonal Pond Project. There'll be tapestries accompanied by words from two local poets, and Anderson's going to give a brief presentation at 5:30.
Also, the 9th Annual Monarch Butterfly Festival is Saturday. From 1 to 4 at the new Bemidji's Veterans Home on Ann Street, there will be speakers, music, and children butterfly parade. Kids should arrive before 3 to create butterfly wings for the parade. I heard your interview with the butterfly. It was very good.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Yeah.
She loves butterflies.
No kidding.
And you can see her photos, Allison Barda. You can see those in that story at our website, kaxe.org. The 18th Annual Great Pumpkin Festival is this Saturday from 1 to 4 at Memorial Park in Brainerd. Enjoy games, crafts, and food. I suspect you probably have made some exquisite carved pumpkins in your life, John, with your attention to detail.
Yeah, I have. Real sharp knife. Mm-hmm. Usually pointy eyes, triangles.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes flip it so the triangle's upside down.
Sure.
Heidi, am I reading that next one correctly?
Yes.
The Iron Range Pasty Festival, Saturday at the Mountain Iron Community Center from 4 to 7. Enjoy pasties made from all local ingredients plus live music and local farm market vendors.
This is The Set List on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at four shows this Friday and Saturday, October 3rd and 4th, in Baxter, Duluth, and Bemidji. First up, Eli Gardner is playing Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter this Friday at 6 p.m. An Americana, gravelly-voiced singer-songwriter who blends folk, rock, and blues with stories of working class and everyday folks. His last album arrived in 2023, but he's released a handful of singles so far this year. Eli Gardner, this Friday, at Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter. On to Saturday for a pair of events in Duluth. First, Duluth Fest runs from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Chester Bowl Park. Inspired by the Lilith Fair Festival of the 90s, the Lilith Fest features an all-women or non-male identifying lineup, including acclaimed folk singer Galen Lee, rising Americana duo The Penny Peaches, Jerry Small, and many more. 11 to 7 this Saturday in Duluth. Then, Canadian country and western singer Coulter Wall is also playing at 7:30 at the Deck Symphony Hall. Known for his deep voice and Townes Van Zandt-inspired songwriting, Wall has been a leading figure in country music since the mid-teens and recently announced his latest album, Memories and Empties, due out in November. It's Coulter Wall this Saturday at the Deck in Duluth. Finally, there is a punk and metal show late Saturday evening at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji. Four bands are on the lineup, including Bemidji group's Rotten Sardines playing punk and metal from Noxious Ghoul. Music begins at 9 p.m. at the Folk School, and the event is hosted by Sundown Records. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Let me know it's spring. They wanna put me in a TV show. I don't know if it's right, but I said yes because I can't refuse those Crystal City lights. Crucified son, I was born the lucky one. They can't tell me what I've done. I'm a crucified son. Don't ask me how I started, 'cause right now I can't recall. It's a wonder me and these boys still out here riding at all. There got to be a higher reason, 'cause it ain't pleasure and fame. I walk out the door, they call me friends and drive nails into my name. Crucified son, they tell me I'm the lucky one. They can't tell me what I've done. I'm a crucified son. Look out. If you love your wife, the women there, they sure are pretty. They'll make you lose your mind.
out behind the Nashville Palace. I got lower than I was in Dallas. Selling idols on a souvenir ain't the only thing happening here. Lord, crucified son, I was born the lucky one. They can't tell me what I done. I'm a crucified son. Crucified son. They tell me I'm the lucky one. From Houston, Texas to Kingdom Come, I'll be a crucified son.
Charlie Crockett off his Dollar a Day release. That song is called Crucified Son. This is the second in his Sagebrush trilogy.
Nice. Yeah.
Trying to get him into the movies. That's what he said there. I'm Heidi Holton. That's John Bauer. I am excited. We've got our talk back segment. Well, before we get to that, John, because a lot of it has to do with our question of the week. And I am been thinking all week long. I can't wait to hear what John is going to have to say about this. What you remember about grocery stores from when you were a kid. And what you, because one of the themes all week, as we'll hear in a few minutes, is people remembering the, you know, getting your groceries bagged and then put in a tub and then you get a number and they go out in the conveyor belt and then there's another person out there that puts them in the car for you. That seems to be just because that doesn't exist anymore. So a lot of people are fondly thinking of that. I yesterday was talking about I would go with my grandma, Ina, who you mm-hmm. met a long time ago. She was always eating everything in the store.
Oh, she'd like try the grapes?
Yeah, but it was more than that. But I was
wait a minute now. More than that?
Oh, yeah. So
what do you mean? She'd open a package?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry.
But my brother was listening yesterday, so I just, you know, threw it out there over the radio waves, like what he remembered. He's 5 years older, so I didn't know if, you know, he goes, yeah, she'd put him in the front seat, you know, and then he said she'd grab a pack of Hydrox cookies because they're cheaper than Oreos. And we would eat them. And that, to me, that was the funniest thing in the text was we would eat them.
You're in the cart now.
Just not the kid, but my grandma was also eating the cookies, right?
Gosh,
and grapes. And yeah, so I have taken after her a little bit. I do test the grapes.
But you don't open anything. You wouldn't open a Twinkie.
No, and this is different than like, you know, when a kid needs to eat and you're going to crack something open or whatever. You know, that happens. Parents need to do that kind of thing. But anyway, I'm laying that out there for you on just one of the memories you might have of grocery shopping.
Well, the thing you talked about where you put your thing in a bucket and it would come out, that was later on. That was like in the 80s. I don't remember that being like in the 60s. And
okay,
stuff.
Okay.
What I remember, I just remember like the meat department, how thrilled I was. I'd stare at the hamburger because it was so red.
Really?
The ground chuck,
sure.
You know? And then the guys with the little hats back there,
yeah,
working in there. I also, I just remember the meat section. My mom and I would always stop at Piggly Wiggly on the west side of town.
Okay, so that's, we got two things yesterday. If you look at our website, this is part of our talkbacks too, but we heard from Kyle and from Mickey. They talked about the Piggly Wiggly just up the hill here because it must have moved or something. It was right, they said the Piggly Wiggly was right here.
Oh, yeah.
But it was also where the Goodwill
was. That's okay. The one I remember.
And we have a great photo from Mickey that she texted in of, as she was a little kid. And she said, occasionally the mascot would show up and it was like this big pig head guy in a costume, but plastic. You could tell it was, you know, it's not like a soft thing. You'll have to look at her website and check it out. But,
you know,
so she'd have to sit in the lap of the, you know,
yeah.
Pig.
But what the thing I remember most is just the checkout ladies. It was always checkout ladies.
Mm-hmm.
And just all walks of life, it seemed like. You'd have an older woman, you'd have a younger person, they'd be snapping gum, they were fantastic. I don't have any drastic memories, but
oh, no,
I just remember staring at the meat and thinking, how in the world did they do that? Then Then getting home and hearing my parents be disgusted that when they opened up the meat, it was brown inside.
Oh.
You know, they put that, they put some sort of solution so the meat, they keep meat red.
Oh.
They put a, I don't know if it's a dye, but they do. And then you would break that beautiful pound of beef and it'd be brown in the middle.
Huh.
A lot of obscenities in the house at that time through with my dad, Bud.
We're still, did you call him Bud?
No. Dad never changed.
We also, we've got some more coming in too that we'll be telling you about today. But before we get to our talkbacks, we heard from Trisha. She said that tonight is Headwaters Music and Arts opening reception for visual artist Diane Roholt, and that's from 5 to 6 p.m. And it is the monthly open mic coffee house that starts at 7, and the featured performer storyteller is Leif Wallen. There'll be a lively evening in Bemidji. Thanks, Trisha. So good to hear what you guys have going on.
I have one more grocery thing. Went to Piggly Wiggly. I've just talked about this before. Went to Piggly Wiggly. I got a giant purple sweet tart. We went to the bridge in Grant Cohasset where he lived. He had to pause so that cars could come because it was a one-lane bridge. A guy hit us just going full speed from behind and just totaled out our car, totaled out all our groceries. Yeah. And the only thing I cared about, not my mom's health, not my health, was this sweet tart. My mom said, just go home. So I had my sweet tart and I walked across the bridge as the police and ambulance were coming.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's kind of bad.
All right.
It's time for the Talkback segment of the morning show. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us comments at kaxe.org or text us 218-326-1234. We got a text Saturday night during After Dark, our program that focuses on different musical genres. Each week they said, as William Cowper said, variety is the spice of life. Come on, mix it up.
Tune in for Headwaters and On the River today with a blend of musical styles. And tomorrow night at 9, it's Diane Ott hosting After Dark, focusing on old-fashioned rock and roll.
Hmm. We had a brand new volunteer on the air Sunday afternoon. And we got a text saying, I look forward to hearing more programming from, and I'm just going to take a shot at this, Stella Alpina Leone. Enjoyed her first time hosting On the River today, including a variety of musicians with topical and uplifting themes.
We love announcing birthdays and anniversaries on Best Wishes. And on Tuesday, we heard back from one birthday boy's mom. Katie from Grand Rapids said, thank you for making Henry's ride to school extra special. He was beaming with joy to hear the birthday shout out.
Wow. Wednesday marked the first day without Corporation of Public Broadcasting. Heidi wrote a column on KAXE.org called The Radio You Need Is Not Guaranteed. We shared it on Facebook and received many comments.
Here's a couple of them that came in. Misty from rural Beauvais said, such a heartfelt post, Heidi. Like I said, when I met you at Riverfest this year, I feel like you're a friend, yet I never met you until that day. I feel the same for so many hosts on KAXE. I'm so grateful for KAXE and everyone who helps to make it work. And Leah also weighed in. She said, KXE is really great, many awesome local programs. With our country in massive debt, changes need to be made. We can't afford as a nation to keep spending what we don't have. Yes, I'm a conservative who enjoys a lot of KXE, except the liberal slant on the news. I am happy that people love it and have extra funds to support it locally, have done so. So again, thanks KXE for unique programming. Love the nature stuff, different music, local programming, Riverfest, green cheese, and thanks to those of you that have extra funds to support it locally. It can be done. This proves it. Good job all around. And you can find a lot more posts on our website to this column.
We've had a lot of response to our question of the week about grocery store memories. Mark from Northeast Landing said, 1965, I'm 5 years old at the Red Owl in Deer River with Grandma, Cracker Jacks and overripe bananas to go home and make bread for the hunters. No kidding.
There's a few. We're going to read a few more of them that have come in. Carrie had texted us yesterday, and Carrie's family, let's see if I can open this while we're talking here, owns a grocery store, and it's still going in Sandstone. And so she had this to say. She said, I fondly remember the small corner grocery store my parents bought the year my older brother was born. I remember the one checkout, the narrow, creaky stairs up to my dad's office where he always had a bag of candy in the bottom desk drawer, often Rolos. I remember Chuck, the meat man, in the small meat room. Then he built a new store when I was about five, I think, and that building underwent many renovations and was the place of my childhood. I'd ride bike in the parking lot on Sunday evenings when my dad went in to close the store. I remember sitting utterly scared in the front of the store by myself in a storm when the power went out. I remember Anita, who worked in produce, wrapping lettuce. We played hide and seek in the back room among the boxes stacked up high. At this store, I spent many hours after school waiting for my parents to pick me up with employees who were like family, offering me rides home. That was way before cell phone days. My mom always pointed out that I was safe and I had plenty of food. This is great. There's more, too. The biggest and the most important memory for me of growing up in a grocery store was not the food shows, though they were so fun with lots of free swag and all the samples you could want. And it was not the times I remember watching Alice, Betty, and Peggy make beautiful hand-lettered signs for the sale items each week. It was not the store parties at Christmas or the post-highway cleanup gatherings. The most important part of the grocery store for me growing up was the way that the employees and the co-workers became like family. Mm-hmm. I was surrounded by so many loving, caring adults throughout my childhood. I learned about loyalty, respect, hard work, and pride in a job well done. My dad was a good man who treated his employees well, and they in turn were loyal. He always wanted the best for them, even if it meant them moving on to other ventures. Both of my parents are now gone, and the old store building sold. After my dad lost his battle to cancer at the age of 60, my brother took over the business. He built a new, bigger store. When he was getting it set up, my boys and I went for a visit, and the cousins played hide-and-seek in the empty aisles and half-filled shelves. Grocery stores are much more than a place to buy food in small towns. For many, they are the heart of the town. They provide employment, field trip opportunities for school children, and a supporter of schools and community events. There is nothing like a small town grocery store.
Mm. You know, another thing I was thinking about is just speaking.
Thanks,
some
Carrie.
The names were great. Red Owl, Piggly mm-hmm. Wiggly. It doesn't happen that way anymore. I guess you've had Cub before, but and one other thing I was thinking about, and this is kind of not on the subject, but I was thinking about this question last night when I heard some of these things. Could you smoke in a grocery store?
Yeah, I don't.
I gotta believe you could. I just gotta believe
but
you
my,
could.
My mom smoked and she never smoked. Of course, she's busy getting all the groceries.
Yeah, right, right.
So I don't know. I don't really
text
know.
Text us if
that.
You remember that. Not that it's important. Just wondering.
Yeah.
218-326-1234.
You know, I just thank Carrie so much for that. Usually we don't get such long stories.
Yeah, no. That's
I love that this is what it brought up for her. You know, maybe you had it sitting around, Carrie, in your drawer, this story, but there's something about it. So this whole thing started because last week it was a serious conversation with a MinnPost reporter who spotlighted three local stores in small town northern Minnesota and how difficult it is economically. There's some federal stuff that they have been able to use when, like, refrigerator systems go down and things like that, but that money's gone. There's just a lot of things changing. And some of these small towns, you know, they're 30 miles from the next door.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a working car, you know, what does this mean? And then in the light of he was tying it all together, Brian Arela, to the what's happening in the federal government and in terms of SNAP benefits as well and how important grocery stores are and changes in reporting on hunger and just at this moment, we're at. And so we took this as a time to celebrate small town grocery stores and what they mean to us to keep us going. You know, we heard from Mark earlier this week. He said it's 1965, 5 years old, Red Owl in Deer River with Grandma, Cracker Jacks, and overripe bananas to go home and make bread for the hunters.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Another thing I remember is you would come across a man or a woman who was putting labels on.
Yeah. Well, Kari and I were remembering yesterday, that I got one year at Christmas, I got a kid's cash register. And so then I would take all the stuff out of make my own grocery store in like another room and then, you know, force my friends or my parents to come shop. And then I was, you know, it seems so much fun, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been so fun to gather the stories. We bring out a question of the week each week, and it really connects us all, remembering or telling stories about yourself and your community.
I want to thank Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses, including cloud solutions, cybersecurity services, network management, and more, all with local customer service and support. Paul Bunyan Communication, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. And we also want to thank Empty Bowls, fighting local hunger and building a stronger community with the Grand Rapids and Deer River Community Cafe. The event takes place Thursday, October 23rd at the Timberlake Lodge from 11 to 2 and 4 to 7. Tickets include soup and a locally made ceramic bowl. More info on Facebook at Itasca Empty Bowls Project.
Got some new stuff coming in here, John. Brandon texted in. He said, in 95, I was in Atlanta building a restaurant. And when you go to the grocery store, yes, people still smoked in the grocery store, even in the produce aisle.
Oh.